Danon Nutritia Campus is an open science education platform for healthcare professionals overseen by a not-for-profit foundation. The foundation is led by an independent board of medical professionals and academics with one clear goal: to advance the field of nutrition and health from infancy to old age through growing knowledge, training and education of healthcare professionals around the world in collaboration with medical and scientific communities.
Welcome and hello, I'm Dr. Roseanne Meyer. I'm a paediatric dietitian and honorary senior lecturer at Imperial College in London, and then also visiting professor at KU Leuven in Belgium. Today, we will be discussing gut and immune health, the safety and added value of pre and symbiotics in the nutrition of allergic infants. We had a really fantastic interaction during our recent webinar on this topic and had loads of questions, but we were not able to address them all. So we are taking this opportunity today to do a podcast and trying to answer many of the outstanding questions. It is my great pleasure to introduce my partners for discussion, who were also the presenters on the webinar, and that's Professor Harald Rentz and then also Professor Anna Novak. And I'm going to give, first of all, Anna Novak, to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself, and then we're moving to Professor Harald Rentz to introduce himself as well.
Thank you, Roseanne. Hello, everyone. I am Anna Novak-Vengzhen, Professor of Pediatrics at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine and the Director of the Division of Pediatric Allergy Immunology at the Hassenfeld Children's Hospital at NYU, New York. Thank you.
And Harald, what about you? Would you introduce yourself as well?
Hi, Roseanne. Hi, Anna. Hi, everybody. Yes, my name is Harald Rentz. I'm Director of the Department of Laboratory Medicine at the University Hospitals in Gießen and Marburg, and I'm Professor of Laboratory Medicine. And our main interest is to study chronic inflammation, particularly in the pre-postnatal environment.
Thank you both. As you can remember, we had a lot of questions. So without further ado, let's jump into it and get to all of the questions. What we've tried to do is kind of put the questions in different sections. And the first section that we're going to address is really the risk factor for cow's milk allergy. And I think the first question is really addressed to all of us, and that is, would you consider a male infant with a father that has severe eczema at higher risk of cow's milk allergy? Anya, I'm going to start with you. What do you think if you had this question from a clinician? So a male infant with a father that has severe eczema, would you consider this as a high-risk child for cow's milk allergy?
You know, I would. I don't think this is a sort of a classical high-risk definition. We usually, like in clinical trials, we use, you know, look at least at two parents or a parent and a sibling with a some atopic condition to be an indicator of the high risk, but you know, it's definitely would consider this in my clinical practice as a as an infant that would have a higher than average chance of developing cow's milk allergy. So it would be more than this 2%, you know, that we get from the population based studies.
And Harald, what do you think about such a practical question?
Yeah, thank you. I fully agree with Anna. I mean, the father has presently severe eczema, so that is a severe form, a severe clinical manifestation of the atopic syndrome. So that would be considered as a genetic predisposition. And it is very important actually to note that even paternal genetics plays an important role also in the transmission of the risk to the next generation. Not only maternal risk factors, but we have also to consider paternal risk factors. Nice case.
Yep. And I really don't have anything to add because I agree with both of you. The next question is a really important question. I'm going to start to pose it to you, Harald, because I think it fits you, and then I'll move over to Anya. Is there any proven effect of antibiotics intrapartum on the GI microbiota of infants and their risk of allergic disease?
Yeah, also very important point. So first of all, I mean, there is now increasing accumulating evidence that actually antibiotics, yes, they are risk, antibiotic treatments are a risk factor for changing the microbiota in the gut. But we have to consider that this is a dose response effect. That means as more courses of antibiotic treatments the baby has received, as higher is the risk. And this counts particularly for prenatal exposures, maternal exposures during pregnancy, so the number of antibiotic courses during pregnancy, plus the number of antibiotic courses past partum. Intrapartum antibiotic courses alone, as such individual exposure, has not been really very well studied, but it would make sense in theory that such an antibiotic course would also contribute for the GI microbiota development. But in summary, it is really the sum, the numbers of treatment courses over a longer period of time, which counts.
Anya, I'm sure you have a lot of parents that come with allergic children already, and the parents saying, I had antibiotics, or mother saying, what do you think if somebody asks you the question around the effect of antibiotics?
Well, I totally, agree with Harold that it depends, you know, when and how those antibiotics have been used. And I'm also not aware of any studies that conclusively show that just a single dose of, you know, antibiotics during delivery, I mean, which is like actually a very common issue, at least, in the United States, because of the group B strep positivity. It's just a routine prophylaxis. So I don't, I would say it's hard to know. Intuitively, you'd think it might have an impact, but there's more evidence regarding use longer courses of antibiotics during pregnancy than just a single dose, intrapartum.
Yeah. So the next question, Harold, again, I'm going to pose to you, and I think it's very similar. It's about a healthy gut microbiome, which of course is dependent on both normal vaginal delivery as well as breastfeeding. So the question is there a place for maternal vaginal swabs placed pre-cesarean section and then applied to the newborn post-delivery to try to administer some of the birth canal bacteria? So I think, the vaginal lavage. And if yes, will the gut microbiome be partially similar or the same as the healthy vaginally delivered breastfed infant?
Well, Roseanne, sorry, this is a superb idea, wonderful concept. But it is still at the level of a concept. There are very few clinical data where vaginal swabs have been used to introduce a vaginal microbiota to the newborn baby following cesarean section. It could be shown that, yes, there is a transient shift in the microbiota in the gut of these babies exposed to these vaginal swabs from the mother, but we need more data. So this concept is at its infancy. We need clinical studies, and particularly we need long-term results. And maybe we can come up later on with a replacement of these swabs by, let's say, an artificial composition or a controlled composition, of these vaginal microbiota. So we have to see and to look for more clinical data.
Yes. So the next question I'm going to pose to myself, because I was very, very fortunate to be present and sharing in the webinar. And it's really during the webinar presentation, the symbiotic blend of prebiotic oligosaccharides and the probiotic strain Bifidobacterium breve M16V rebalanced the gut microbiota to be more closer to healthy breastfed infants. So the question is, when breastfeeding is not possible, and we're recommending symbiotic blend to children at risk of cow's milk allergy, should it be given in combination with a polymeric cow's milk formula or partially hydrolyzed formula, or extensively hydrolyzed formula or amino acid formula. I think first there needs to be some clarification around the data that was presented, which was really on an amino acid formula with the symbiotic blend. So the data of it normalizing or bringing the gut microbiota closer to that of the breastfed infant was presented, was in used for children with a cow's milk allergy, so not for prevention, and that was an amino acid formula. So I think the question, in fact, is a different question. The question is most probably on allergy prevention and symbiotics. And I think here, and where Anya can certainly help me, but none of the current guidelines which recommend extensively hydrolyzed formula, amino acid formula for prevention. All of the newer guidelines, including our guidelines in the UK, now recommend just a whole protein standard infant formula if breast milk is not available. Then the question for me is, do you then add a symbiotic blend to a whole protein? Because there is actually some studies on using, you know, just it as a symbiotic supplement. And so for me, I would lean towards what are your guidelines saying and where the research is, which is at the moment, most of the guidelines go towards a polymeric whole protein feed for prevention. Anya, would you say that is more or less what you have in the US as well, or have you got different?
No, absolutely. This is what we recommend also. So we no longer think that using hypoallergenic formula or a partially hydrolyzed formula is appropriate for prevention in infants at risk. So yes, absolutely. Just using a polymeric cow's milk formula is the right way to go.
Perfect. Thank you. So we're moving back to Harald, because of course, this is really a section that has a lot of questions for you. So the next question is, how is the microbiota from skin and gut associated in the development of allergic disease?
This is a big question, yeah. And also a great question, of course. So most of the data we have stand for the gut microbiota and the association of allergy. Number one, few points to this. Number one, there's clear evidence that allergic individuals exhibit a dysbiosis in the gut microbiota when they are sick, when they have asthma or food allergy, or even in several studies also shown for eczema. So dysbiosis means a qualitative and quantitative disruption of the composition of a microbiota. Second, the question is this causal or is this just an association? And for this, we have now, I think, accumulated more and more data indicating, yes, there seems to be a cause-effect relationship between this dysbiosis and the disease development. Why? Now, first of all, dysbiosis seems to precede the onset of the disease. So dysbiosis is first, the disease development comes later. And from secondly, from experimental data, it is quite impressive that one can transfer the disease by such a disrupted microbiota collected from allergic individuals, transfer into germ-free mice. And when these germ-free mice develop disease and vice versa, one can also show that one can prevent anaphylactic reactions, food allergy in germ-free mice by reconstitution of the gut microbiota in these animals by a healthy gut, healthy microbes, or microbes collected from healthy individuals. So in summary, there is now more and more evidence for a cause-effect relationship. But this is mainly for GI microbiota, not so much for the skin microbiota. This field is still a little bit behind in terms of the amount of research data available so far.
Thank you for that that answer, Harald. I think it's a very exciting area to when I listen to what you are sharing with us. The next question, Harald, is again for you. It's a question that I have to try to interpret with what the question is meaning. So I hope you and me can interpret it together. So are there any differences in the gut microbiota and gut microbiota development and fragility in children with IgE-mediated cow's milk allergy versus non-IgE-mediated allergy. So I've been thinking what the term fragility means, and I'm not sure whether it means atopic comorbidity or the fact that children with IgE-mediated allergies and non are more prone to infections. But I think you can interpret the question in any way you would like to interpret it.
No, thanks, Roseanne. I mean, this is very similar to what we just discussed previously. So most of the data stand for IgE-mediated cow's milk allergy, actually. And for non-IgE-mediated allergy, there are less data available. But the data available indicate that, there is this disruption in the, this might be the fragility in this case. I would interpret the term fragility in this regard as the dysbiosis, the disruption in the composition of the gut microbiota. Yes, there is also fragility, dysbiosis in the non-IgE-mediated allergic infants. There is, I mean, first of all, when it comes to the taxa, to the exact microbes which differ between healthy and allergic, there's lots of variability from study to study. So there is not a clear picture, let's say. We cannot say this microbiotic fingerprint looks like IgE-mediated, and there's a different microbiota fingerprint for non-IgE-mediated allergy. So in principle, we can say disruption of gut microbiota also plays a role in non-IgE-mediated allergy, but we have less data, we need more evidence and more functional data for this.
Thank you very much, Harald. We are now moving to more questions for Anja around the clinical study results that were presented. Anja, you presented the outcomes of the PRESTO study. You showed that approximately 50% of infants receiving the amino acid formula with and without Symbiotic Blend developed oral tolerance within 12 months. Did you also evaluate the tolerance at 12 months of age? And did you see a difference?
Well, so in this clinical trial, we did look at the tolerance development after 12 months of intervention. So, infants were enrolled within the first year of life, but the median age of the participant was about 9 months. So we did not challenge those infants at 12 months of age. We challenged them 12 months after they have been enrolled in the study. So we could not comment on any differences, at 12 months of age.
Thank you for that answer. And I think it kind of feeds nicely into the next question, which is why do you think the PRESTO trial did not show a benefit in terms of resolution of cow's milk allergy?
So, this will be just hypothesis. We really don't understand exactly what are the single reason. Probably there was not a single reason. But I think that one of the possibilities might be that the age of the infants was a little bit older than other studies that have looked at the effect of formulas. As I mentioned before, it was about 9 months, even though we were recruiting infants within the first year of life. When we looked, in the secondary analysis at the amount of formula that was being ingested by younger infants versus older infants, obviously it was higher among the younger infants, and we've shown a little bit of a stronger signal in terms of tolerance development among those that were younger. They were ingesting more formula as well. They had lower markers of cow's milk allergy. So potentially we just didn't have a enough sample size. We would have needed a much larger study to show an effect in those older infants, or we should have enrolled infants at a much younger ages. Another factor that might have fed into this is that we have really enrolled infants with a more severe form of cow's milk allergy. So our study was focused on infants with IgE-mediated cow's milk allergy. We did include infants with a past history of anaphylaxis, as well as with other food allergies. So those infants have not been excluded. So potentially we have seen a more severe forms of food allergy.
I think that's an excellent answer. You know, I was not involved in PRESTO. I was in the non-IgE mediated trial. Mm-hmm. Similarly, we didn't look at resolution, but we were really wondering whether the age of the children, because many of them, what happened before they were enrolled, I do think plays a role.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's another point is that because they were 9 months, right? So that they were not like newborns, they many of them, and we were not the first ones who were establishing the diagnosis of cosmogalgy. They've already went through a number of formula changes. So it's hard to know whether this has, you know, affected the, the effect of the study product. And another thing is that because they were older, they also had more complementary foods, which were also contributing to the, you know, effect on microbiota. So
yeah, so I think it's complex. So the next one again, this is quite a tricky one and a tricky but a very important question. So how do you think clinical study results with symbiotic blends compare to those with the Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG or the synthetic HMO studies?
So I think it's a very important question. So to the best of my knowledge, there are no published studies of tolerance development in infants fed with the synthetic, with cow's milk formula or hypoallergenic formula that was supplemented with synthetic HMO. So I'm only aware of the effects on, you know, tolerance growth as well as the frequency of the infections. But there are studies that publish the results of extensively hydrolyzed formula with Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG. And those studies have shown the difference in tolerance development. But direct comparison is really very tricky. There are different study populations. So for instance, PRESTO study was a multi-center international studies that were done, you know, in Europe, in the US, in Asia, versus the Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG study was done, you know, in Italy, although it was a multi-center study. But I think more importantly, the age of the infants who were enrolled in the study was also significantly different, with the Lactobacillus GG infants having a median age of 5 months compared to our PRESTO study of 9 months. So I think it's a very, at this distance, you know, which might account for those, for the differences. And another very important point to make is that in the PRESTO study, as I mentioned before, we did include infants with a more severe form of IgE-mediated cow's milk allergy, especially those with the past history of anaphylaxis, as well with the multiple food allergies to other, you know, to other foods. And those infants were specifically excluded from the studies were looking at Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG. So I think that, you know, those are potentially the important reasons why we've seen differences in outcomes.
Yeah, and I think you can't compare apples to pears.
Yeah.
You know, the type of population you have and the type of population on an extensively hydrolyzed formula is very different. We are now moving towards the domain of questions that are trying to address the more practical use of the biotics. And I think that's really why many of the people would be listening to this podcast, because we want to know, although research is very interesting, what can we do now? So this question is really to all of us, and it's really about talking about the discussion in the webinar with the practical use. And so we said, and which infant should we avoid the use of probiotics and therefore symbiotics? For example, should we avoid it in preterm or very low birth weight babies? Or should we avoid in severely immunocompromised, and why? And why are prebiotics okay? So Anya, I'm going to start with you because it's, you know, it's such a clinical question. What do you think in regards to which population should we be avoiding probiotics and therefore symbiotics, and why is a prebiotic okay?
Well, and you know, I'll be very curious to see what you and Harald think. You know, all of the studies that I'm aware of were done in term infants, so presumably healthy. And actually, we did exclude those that have any other severe diseases. And I don't know if there are any formulas that are specifically containing symbiotics that are specifically developed for preterm and very low birth weight infants. Those, you know, those that group of infants, is considered immunocompromised. They are born with an immature immune system. We know that they are more prone to infection. So I think that I would have concerns without having extensive studies of giving them live bacteria, even though, you know, the bacteria that are being used in the formula have been, very carefully chosen, and they are truly, healthy gut bacteria, and as well as, present in healthy infants that are breastfed. So, I would still like to see more data on that, specifically, with products developed for that age group and as well as like for severely immunocompromised patients. I don't have any concerns about prebiotics. Obviously, this is not a live pathogen or potential pathogen, right? And they should be fine. But again, I don't know if we have done any studies, and maybe, Harold or some additional evidence that would say that we are ready to have like a blanket, statement that we should, newborn baby should be fed with this, with symbiotics or prebiotics.
Harold, what do you think around the safety of the use of probiotics, yeah, Symbiotics and prebiotics?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, safety here is really the issue, and safety concerning the administration, the use of live microbes. I mean, that is the issue. So this is why probiotics and symbiotics are really here on the table. And safety issues come from two angles. Number one is the immunocompromised situation. Of course, very low birth infants are deficient with regard to some immune answers, not to all immune answers, but to some immune answers. And then we have also patients with acquired or inherited immunodeficiencies. So this is really a safety concern. The other safety concern is in a situation where you have a disrupted epithelial barrier in the gut, during infectious diseases, for instance, GI tract infectious diseases, diarrhea, and something like that. So in these situations, I would avoid the use of live bacteria.
I think from my perspective, because I work from a clinical side, and of course I concur with you, but I think the difficulty is what we all define as immunocompromised. Having worked on a pediatric intensive care unit, the question is the patient on the pediatric intensive care unit immunocompromised? And in 1998, I embarked on a probiotic study in intensive care and pediatrics. Mm-hmm. And it was a really good example of you can be using it. So my message is, first of all, symbiotic blend that we've been talking about in this webinar has not been tested in preterm infants. So I think that is very clear. So safety studies are all in full-term infants. If you're a neonatologist here, if you're working with preterm infants, of course, we're talking about neck and those. This is not part of the remit of the webinar on our podcast, but then you need to go into the specific studies. There are specific studies looking at probiotics for neck prevention. So I think for me is look at the studies on which strains are safe in which situation, and that is critical. And otherwise, urge on caution and say, well, as a rule of thumb, if you're severely immunocompromised, it's an absolute no. And I agree with Anya that if we're thinking about prebiotics and we're thinking about breast milk, of course, that's not a live entity. So if we move to the next question. Anya, I'm going to start with you. Is how long do you have to give a hydrolyzed formula? And I'm going to say extensively hydrolyzed formula here, or an amino acid-based formula before changing to one with symbiotics? And I think that's an important one. So do you start with it? Do you wait? Do you step over? So what would your practice be?
I'm just thinking, Roseanne, I really don't have like a set time. Usually when the infants that I see, right, in my practice are a bit older, usually around 6 months of age, they've already been given diagnosis. So I don't think there is a set time that you would say, oh, we have to, you know, give a hydrolase formula without, or amino acid based formula without. I think if you think that this is the right choice, if in your opinion symbiotics are beneficial to those infants, I'm not worried about sort of testing this formulation without symbiotics, because we know that the head-to-head studies have shown that they're both well tolerated, they support growth, so I think at this point with the evidence that we have would be, okay, do we think that this is the right choice? I would just go for it, if there is a clinical situation. I don't have a time that I wait. No, I don't know. I don't know if you have a guideline for that.
I actually think there are two questions. I think the first question is, how long do you give time to go for an extensively hydrolyzed formula to an amino acid formula? And that depends on your symptom improvement and resolution. For us, it's between 2 to 4 weeks,
Yeah, agree.
And then the question then is, do you start with an extensively hydrolyzed formula with a probiotic or, a prebiotic, or do you, or an amino acid formula with a symbiotic? And I think the answer you gave is absolutely right. You follow your clinical practice of saying extensively hydrolyzed and amino acid, and you from the start, for us, we would go from the start with the symbiotic if that we think is the right choice. I think also we need to bring in here, certainly from the data, we have a government health system in the UK. Our data shows that what wastes cost is frequent feed changes. So, to constantly change to feed has got a cost implication. So that we try to limit the number of feed changes. And I think for us, it's pretty simple. I don't know. Harald, I know you want to weigh into this. I saw you showing something with your hand. Would you want to weigh in on this?
Nothing to add. I agree. Fully agree.
So let's go to the next question. I think this is a question to all of us. From what age is a symbiotic containing formula most beneficial? And I want to say, in the absence of breast milk. So that's really important. And do you recommend starting before 6 months of age, ideally? Harald, I'm going to start with you. So I think we have to be really clear. This is if there's no breast milk available. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, if there is no breast milk available. So what do we want to achieve with this symbiotic regimen? We want to foster the development of tolerance. And for tolerance development, we have a limited window of opportunity from the timing. So I would say, and this window is early on, after birth, and continues maybe the next few months, maximum maybe 1 year, to really change the game. So I would say as sooner as better.
Yep. And Anya, what would you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I sort of think about like symbiotic containing formula, just a step closer to breast milk. Breast milk is not a sterile fluid. It has bacteria. It has human milk oligosaccharides. So prebiotics. Of course, it has other, ingredients as well that are immunomodulatory. So I would think, if you cannot breastfeed, you would like to use something that would be as closely emulating breast milk as possible. So I don't see the, I think sooner the better. And the sooner, at younger ages, this the formula that is the sole sort of source of nutrition has a much higher impact than in older ages, after weaning. So I think, the first 6 months are critical.
I totally agree. And I think something that we should not forget here, although this podcast is about symbiotics and the microbiome, but it's also about identifying and managing cow's milk allergy as early as possible. So above all of this is starting when the symptoms are actually identified. That's also important to start if there's no breast milk available, starting the right hypoallergenic formula. And then, of course, it's an added benefit if you've got symbiotics added to that. So we're coming to the last question, which is a meaty question, and it's a question around the guidelines. So do guidelines from, for example, Espegan recommend the use of pre, pro, and symbiotics in atopic dermatitis and or cow's milk allergy, and why or why not do they recommend? I'm going to, Harald, start with you because you kind of represent the European side of this, and then I'll move to Anja. What do you think?
Well, so in terms of atopic dermatitis, at least from a German perspective, and this is probably also the case for Espargan on the European level, for atopic dermatitis, we do have significant evidence for the use of probiotics. So I would add to this also synbiotics as well, that this can be a game changer. Although the effect size is not so big, but on the other side, you do nothing wrong with that. And this cow's milk allergy, we have just discussed what to do. I mean, to, in the case breastfeeding is not available, to move to symbiotics as early as possible.
Absolutely. Anja, and you know, you've got the more North American kind of perspective. What do your guidelines say?
Well, the official guidelines do not recommend. There's no official recommendation to use pre-pro symbiotics. And you know, like when you are familiar with guidelines development, you know how rigorous this the grading system is and the evaluation of evidence, and you need large, you know, clinical trials and preferably several of them to lead to changes in the guidelines. So I'm thinking we're moving probably towards that. You know, we're working on the revision of DRACMA, for instance, and we'll be as a group of sort of independent experts looking at the evidence, and you know, maybe there I don't know yet what's going to come out of that review of the more recent evidence. But currently, based on what's available, there's not enough evidence for the like professional society to, you know, to make official recommendations or population based on expert opinion and limited evidence.
And I think you highlighted something really important, is that because the way that the studies were performed so vastly different, so and also strains used, so it's really difficult then to come up with some kind of consensus. I particularly like, you know, the World Allergy Organization on their opinion, although they've graded it, and as a whole they say all recommendations are conditional, supported by very low quality evidence. But I think there's some pragmatic suggestion to say, you know, that using probiotics of infants at higher risk of developing allergy may be useful, but it's again weighed up that you're not doing any harm. And I think that's what Harald says there, is you have to really weigh that up. So we're actually coming now to the end of this podcast, and on gut and immune health, the safety and added value of pre and symbiotics in the nutrition of allergic infants. I want to thank you both, Anja and Harald, for this really lively and fruitful discussion. And I'm going to end up with asking both of you, starting with you, Harald, with your key takeaway message on this topic. So Harald, what are your key takeaway messages?
So the message really is, there is a very close interaction between the diet, the microbes, and the immune system. And if we want to improve immunological and clinical tolerance, we have to use this concept now beyond the bench, beyond the animal systems. We have to take this concept to the patient.
And Anja, after that amazing takeaway key message, what would your key message be?
I would say that the infant formulas, both you know, hypoallergenic amino acid base that are enriched with symbiotics, as well as probably as well as intact cow's milk protein, are most closely resembling the breast milk. So they should be considered in feeding of infants who cannot be breastfed, both infants at risk and as well as, you know, general infant population, because there is an excellent safety you know, evidence, and also evidence that they do change the microbiota of infants who are formula fed to that resembling more those of healthy breastfed infants, with one caveat that we are not recommending those formulas for immunocompromised, very low birth weight and premature babies. But healthy term infants who cannot be breastfed, you know, the formula with symbiotics should be considered.
And it's now my turn to give my takeaway message. I think from both of you, I think what both of you really have highlighted, because Anjan, the study you had breastfed infants, you know, that is your gold standard. And what you've mentioned, Harald, is that you again have mentioned the importance of early and colonization. And I think for me, the takeaway message is breast milk remains your gold standard. We as healthcare professionals should be supporting breastfeeding. And I think also we have what you've demonstrated. We've moved away just from simple cow's milk elimination diets. We've moved into the next stage where we are actively managing and thinking of ways to modulate the immune system per se, where your gastrointestinal tract plays an absolute critical role. And on this note, I want to thank both you, Harald and Anja, and of course the listeners for taking the time to view the webinar, which this discussion relates to. Please go to nutritia-campus.com. And thank you for listening, and thank you to both speakers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Date with future episodes of Done on Nutritia Campus, the Feed podcast. Make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. For more updates on the show, or for more educational content from Done on Nutritia Campus, visit www.doneonnutritiacampus.org.